Okay, good morning, everybody. This is File 241, and it's March 10th. We're going to finish up nervous system today. And let's see, test next time, right, on Tuesday. And let me turn some of these lights down. And what do we have on the projector over here? You know it that well. I hope so. It's something you should know. What? Forwards and backwards. Okay. So let's not belabor that point. Let's go to, I'll put the same slide on both. At least that's the plan. 1-1. Okay, so we were talking last time, right as we finished, something about graded potentials. So we're going to contrast graded potentials with action potentials. So we learned a lot about action potentials. Give me a couple characteristics of an action potential. It's an all or none response, that's right. And same duration at action potential will last in time. It's invariant, it never changes duration. And what else? Amplitude is always the same, one action potential. So in this sense, the amplitude, which is the height of an action potential, and the duration are all equivalent. They're all the same. All action potentials are the same. And they're the same at the axon hillock and the axon terminus. Right? So an action potential is propagated down an axon in what kind of fashion? Would you say propagation is without decrement? Yeah, without decrement. An action potential, no matter where you measure it, is always going to be the same. As opposed to graded potentials, which we started talking about last time. If we inject some kind of positive charge into a cell, right, that's going to change the electrical properties of that cell and set up an electromagnetic field inside the cell or a wave, and it's going to move from this place of origin, and as it moves, it runs into resistance inside the cell, and some of the charge can actually leak outside of the cell. So due to those two effects, we notice that the amplitude decreases as this wave moves across the cell, and it will just die away, kind of like ringing of a bell. Okay, so graded potentials are conducted over a cell in what we call with decrement. It will fade away. Okay, so that's the big difference between a graded potential. So if we think of action potentials once again, now what allows an action potential to take place on a cell as opposed to that graded potential where we just injected some positive current? It's got to have some membrane components. As a matter of fact, two membrane components. What are the two membrane components an action potential needs, desperately needs, in order to? A sodium channel and a potassium channel, right? And what kind of channels are these? They are, yeah, membrane channels, but they're not open all the time. Sometimes they're closed, sometimes they're open. So we call it, what, a gated channel. But what opens and closes that gate? Yeah, it's a voltage-gated channel. So depending on the voltage across a membrane, then these channels will be opened or closed. That's what produces an action potential. So here we have an unmyelinated axon, and that means that if we inject some kind of positive current in or charge in this part of the axon, right, and we start a graded potential, it's going to die away very rapidly, right? And that's why we need action potential, so that information can be carried throughout the whole length of an axon. But that graded potential, right, can act as a stimulus, right? It can reach threshold, it can change the membrane potential, and it will open up some sodium voltage-gated channels, and that will then start an action potential. If it's an unmyelinated fiber, that action potential has to move, right, just molecule by molecule, membrane channel, one right after the other, all the way down the axon. If we have a graded potential, it moves through this space right here, basically at whatever the speed of light is in this particular medium, which is what? Damn fast, right? Just speed of light is very, very fast. So this electromagnetic wave as it's moving through a cell is just a physical property of of any kind of electromagnetic radiation is very, very fast. Unfortunately, for graded potentials, what happens to it? It dies away, right? It rings away. So biology has figured out a way, once we have reached stimulus, to maintain that electrical signal all the way down to the axon terminus. But this can't travel as fast as an electromagnetic wave, right? It's got to be a little bit slower, because what has to happen? Those gates have to open and close, right? And that takes a fair amount of time for that to happen. All right, so an action potential moving down through an axon is relatively slow. First, you have one area of depolarization, it moves to another area, right, and then another area, and then following it, you have that area of depolarization. All right, so this is a relatively slow process compared to a graded potential. But what's the beauty of that? You don't lose the signal from the axon hillock down to the axon terminus. It's relatively slow, and so that's about, 2 miles per hour when that happens. So that's a very slow process. But that also has some ramifications. When we have an action potential moving down an axon, we call that a nerve impulse, right? That's just a nerve impulse, action potential moving down an axon. And which way is a nerve impulse always conducted? And you should probably have a reason why in your mind as to why that happens. It always moves from the cell body down to this axon terminus right here. And one of the reasons why has to do with this red area right here, which is repolarization due to potassium. But what else is happening in this red area right here? What about, can this part of the axon be re-stimulated at this particular time? It cannot, because of what? The absolute refractory period and a relative refractory period. So because of the refractory period, a nerve impulse can really only go in one direction. It can't go what we say retrograde, because these retrograde regions right here are what? In a refractory period. So that's why information just travels down an axon in one direction. Okay. But if we have an oligodendrocyte in the central nervous system or a Schwann cell in the peripheral nervous system that can insulate these axons, and what kind of chemical is used as insulation? Myelin, right? If they put a myelin sheath around this axon right here, whenever we inject some positive charges into this node between the cells, that graded potential, right, which moves how? How does a graded potential move in terms of speed? The graded potential is fast, but unfortunately it dies away, can't travel long distances. It's fast, that graded potential, right, spreads a wave of the electrical wave down to the next node, right? But because the myelin doesn't allow the electrical signal to leak out of the nerve, right, it is still at threshold when it hits this next node right here. And what is, and if it's at threshold at this, at the second node, what happens automatically? An action potential, right? And then that sets up another graded potential underneath this myelin sheath, which travels how? In terms of speed. Very fast down to this node right here, right? And because of the myelin, the signal doesn't die away by the time it gets to this node. It's still at threshold. That then opens up, right? That starts another action potential just in this region. So an action potential actually hops from node to node to node, and underneath the Schwann cell, it just travels extremely, extremely fast. But there are no action potentials underneath the Schwann cell because there are no voltage-gated channels in this region right here. Right, the job of this region right here is to insulate the axon so that electrical charges can neither enter or leave the axon. Right, so that makes the duration or the distance of travel for a graded potential longer because of the myelin sheath right here. And since action potentials then can hop down an axon, look at the speed. It can be as high as 300 miles per hour as a result of that. Okay, now I guess I could have another question, and that is, why can't cells use a graded potential if it's very fast from the axon hillock all the way down to the axon terminal? It would be lightning fast, but how come it doesn't work that way? Because that graded potential dies away. It can only go this microscopic distance right here, and then it will no longer be at threshold, and the signal dies away, right? So you need some voltage-gated channels right here to sense just that little bit of threshold voltage, and that starts another action potential, right? And it will hop down to here and here. All right, so that's a very fast way of transmitting information. So you have to know that these nodes between Schwann cells are called nodes of Ranvier, and that you only have these voltage-gated channels in the nodes, not underneath the myelinating cells. And when a signal can hop from one node to the other, that's called saltatory conduction, and that is hundreds of times faster than what we say is continuous conduction in an unmyelinated fiber. So that's the job of myelination. All right, so let's look at a synapse. And a synapse is a structural and functional unit of communication between two cells. So cells do need to communicate with each other. We looked at the various kinds of chemical messengers in previous chapters. All right, and there are two kinds of synapses. There are what we call chemical synapses and electrical synapses. So a synapse is just a junction between two cells, and a chemical synapse needs a chemical to be transferred from one cell to the second cell. The first cell that's going to be releasing the chemical is called the presynaptic cell, and the cell receiving that information is what we call the postsynaptic cell. Even if it's an electrical synapse, we could probably use that same terminology as well. All right. Synaptic or chemical synapses are very common in your body. Electrical synapses are pretty rare, but we're going to see an example of a very important location for them. All right, so let's start with an electrical synapse first. This is the easiest one to imagine. So here we have two neighboring cells, and we can see their plasma membranes almost touching each other. There's a little bit of extracellular space. But between these cells, we see some connexin proteins that form gap junctions, which is a physical bridge of cytosol between these two cells. So the cytosol or cytoplasm of these two cells are connected, even though they're still separated by a plasma membrane. All right, so this is a special kind of synapse between these two cells, because if a positive charge was injected into the top cell over here, that electromagnetic wave then, and even sodium, could diffuse into this second cell. So if sodium is the reason why this cell is being depolarized right here, we have a higher concentration of sodium in the top cell, it can then diffuse into the bottom cell. And when it diffuses into the bottom cell, what happens to the bottom cell? Does it hyperpolarize or depolarize or what? It depolarizes, right? It becomes less negative. And what did we say about depolarization? Is that a stimulatory event, excitatory event, or inhibitory? It's excitatory, right? So this cell gets excited by the same stimulus that excited the top cell. So electrical synapses operate very fast, and it's a way when one cell becomes stimulated, all the neighboring cells around it will be stimulated as well. So that has some important implications, especially for the heart, because the heart has to contract as a unit. If one part of the heart, say the right side of the heart, can't contract, and then the bottom part, and then another side of the heart, it has to contract as a unit. So as soon as one cell gets excited into contraction, the whole heart contracts as a unit, because, you know, in intercalated discs, we have gap junctions. All right. And of course, we don't want that same kind of synapse between skeletal muscles, because what would happen to you if you reached out for like a drink right here, like my Dr. Pepper? Right? We excited one muscle cell or one muscle, what would happen to all the muscles in your body? They would contract, and of course, that wouldn't work. You'd never get any Dr. Pepper if that were to happen. Okay. So different synapses are used for different reasons. So here is a pretty good example of a chemical synapse, and we see an axon terminus right here. Sometimes we call this a Bouton terminale. It's just a little swelling at the end of an axon, or terminal swelling, or terminal Bouton. It runs around with a whole bunch of different kinds of names. It's a bit of a swelling down at the axon terminus because it contains numerous synaptic vesicles. So these are vesicles that contain neurotransmitter. These are the chemicals that are going to be released into the synaptic cleft, or the space between the presynaptic and the postsynaptic cell, which will carry information to the postsynaptic cell. But this is also an active process. So what else do you have to have in this terminal button right here? You've got to have mitochondria, right? So it's a busy place that's generating a lot of ATP, and it's got a lot of other machinery for synaptic transmission. So these neurotransmitters are released when an action potential comes down the axon. Okay, and what's the first event of an action potential? Is depolarization, right? And when this area depolarizes in the terminal button, there are also voltage-gated calcium channels. So when these channels reach threshold, calcium enters the cell. Because where do you remember calcium is at a high concentration? Outside the cell, almost zero inside the cell. So when these gates open up, right, calcium rushes into the cell, and that acts as a signal to cause release of neurotransmitter. All right, so here is a molecule that binds calcium, and it's called calmodulin. So this is something that binds calcium and can modulate physiology inside the cell in a chemical sense. It can then interact with a protein kinase. Ooh, tell me something about protein kinase. A protein kinase can run around inside the cell and do what? Phosphorylate proteins, right? And so when it phosphorylates proteins, it can activate them or inactivate them. It's a pretty big group, right? It's going to change some kind of conformation in that protein. So when calmodulin binds calcium, it converts protein kinase into an active form. Protein kinase runs around and it starts to phosphorylate regulatory proteins inside this terminal button right here, which cause docking, fusion, and release of neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. Okay, so you should be familiar with calmodulin. It binds a calcium signal, which is usually trapped outside the cell, but the action potential allows it to enter the terminal button right here. All right, when neurotransmitter is released, it just diffuses down its concentration gradient. It's highest at the presynaptic membrane, diffuses over to the postsynaptic membrane, and there it stimulates the postsynaptic cell. So, how does that happen? Here's the next slide on that. We talked about all this. All right, I guess I'm going to stay on this figure right here. When this neurotransmitter, okay, bumps into the plasma membrane, it has to bump into something special called a receptor. And there is a special association with a neurotransmitter and receptor, and it's based on shape. The shape of the receptor has to be complementary to the neurotransmitter, kind of like a lock and key or hand and glove fit. And when the neurotransmitter binds, it's going to change the electrical properties of this cell. Now, what ways do you know to change an electrical property of a cell? You know two ways. You can depolarize it, or you can hyperpolarize it. How would you depolarize this cell right here? Think of what? An action potential. And yeah, how does an action potential depolarize? By allowing sodium to enter the cell. So when a neurotransmitter bumps into a receptor right here, binds to a receptor, that opens up a sodium channel, a sodium-gated channel, or actually it's going to be a neurotransmitter-gated channel. It opens up the sodium channel so sodium enters the cell because, you know, sodium is high outside, low inside. And when sodium enters this cell, the postsynaptic cell, what happens to its membrane potential? It moves closer to zero. We typically call that depolarization. Depolarization is what? Excitatory or inhibitory on a cell? It's excitatory. So this cell is excited when neurotransmitter binds to the receptor. And this postsynaptic cell can only be sensitive to these neurotransmitters if it has what? The receptor on the postsynaptic membrane. Okay, so those channels are opened and closed by when they bind to neurotransmitters. So those are not voltage-gated channels. Sometimes we call a neurotransmitter a ligand. A ligand is a small molecule that binds to a bigger molecule. And in this case, the small molecule is a neurotransmitter coming from the presynaptic cell. It binds to a bigger molecule on the postsynaptic membrane, which is the receptor. All right, so those kinds of channels are what we call ligand-gated channels. Ligand-gated channels open and close depending on whether or not they have bound that particular ligand that has the shape to bind to its active site. All right, so there are two important kinds of gated channels. There are voltage-gated channels. You've got sodium and potassium for an action potential. You also have a calcium voltage-gated channel right here that controls the release of neurotransmitter. And now here is a different kind of channel. It's a ligand-gated channel that opens when it binds a ligand like a neurotransmitter. Okay, so we've talked about this right here, neurotransmitter release. We talked about this slide already. Okay, this slide actually tells us that there can be two kinds of events when a ligand binds to a ligand-gated channel. All right, so this neurotransmitter, which is the ligand, diffuses across the synaptic cleft, binds to a receptor protein on the postsynaptic membrane. Can you picture that postsynaptic membrane, where it is? Right, it's over here someplace. Okay. And depending on what kind of ligand channel it is, it can excite the cell or it can inhibit the cell. So let's see if we can figure out why that is. What's a typical way that you can excite a cell? What kind of channel would you want to open? A sodium channel, okay. But now what happens if you open up a potassium channel? What's going to happen to the membrane potential? It's going to hyperpolarize, right? And think of that drawing of an action potential. When a cell hyperpolarizes, does the membrane potential get closer to threshold or is it driven farther away from threshold? It's farther away. So typically, we say when a cell is hyperpolarized, when potassium is leaving the cell, right, is that excitatory or inhibitory? It's inhibitory because the membrane potential moves farther away. It becomes more negative. It moves farther away from threshold. So it needs a higher excitation in order to be excited, right? It's driven farther away from threshold. So the two kinds of membrane potentials that can be developed on the postsynaptic membrane, right, is there can be depolarizing channels that open, right, and these we call produce EPSPs, excitatory postsynaptic potentials. They're excitatory because they cause depolarization on the postsynaptic membrane. All right, but if a neurotransmitter opens up not a sodium channel but a potassium channel, then that inhibits the cell because it hyperpolarizes the membrane. So when that happens, it produces an IPSP, or an inhibitory postsynaptic potential, right? And when we say postsynaptic, can you picture where that is? That's on the postsynaptic cell, right? The cell that comes after the synapse. Okay, so these EPSPs and IPSPs then initiate graded potentials, right? Waves of electromagnetic field through the cell, and if those graded potentials run into voltage-gated channels at threshold, what's going to start? An action potential, right? So these EPSPs and IPSPs are a lot different than action potentials because they travel a lot faster, but they die away. But these can also summate. They can interact with each other. So what can you tell me about an EPSP and an IPSP? They're antagonistic to each other. They'll cancel each other out. All right, and so typically when we add up information, when we add information, what do we call that? Whether it's if we have positive information and negative information added together, what are we doing? We are integrating. We call that integration, right? So neurons can get information and integrate it up and then make a decision. What part of the cell makes a decision whether to send the information further on down the line? It is that axon hillock that has those voltage-gated channels. Okay, so every neuron is really interesting because it makes decisions for us based on integrating information from various EPSPs and IPSPs that are presented to it. All right, so these EPSPs and IPSPs do what? They affect voltage-gated channels in the postsynaptic cell. They're graded potentials. These are set up due to not voltage-gated channels, but ligand-gated channels. Where do we have these ligand-gated channels on a neuron? We know of three important places on a neuron. We got dendrites, we have cell body, and axons. Okay, so where do we have ligand-gated channels? What's the receiving part? The dendrite is the receiving part of a neuron because it has a ligand-gated channel, not voltage-gated channels. But you know what? Even cell bodies have ligand-gated channel. So a cell body is a receiving part of the neuron as well. I should probably have that little drawing up over on this other slide over here. You might want to just pull that out and take a look at that. All right, so ligand-gated channels are dendrites, neuron cell body only. These graded potentials are variable in amplitude depending on how much neurotransmitter is released by the presynaptic cell. It can produce a greater or lesser graded potential and a greater or lesser duration of a graded potential as well. All right, but these graded potentials move very fast, but as soon as they start to move over a dendrite or cell body, they start to die away. All right, so you can't go from the cell body down to the tip of an axon with one. And graded potentials do add together. They summate. So let me take a look at this question right here. What part of a neuron is the receiving part and why? You should probably have a really good picture of that. The receiving part is the dendrite and cell body. If you want to say soma, that's fine. But more importantly, why is that? Because it has receptors for neurotransmitters, but these receptors are special. They're what? They're ligand-gated channels, right? So they can sense chemical messengers, right? And when a chemical messenger binds to them, they open up and allow sodium to enter, or maybe to excite the cell, or maybe a potassium channel, which then inhibits the cell. All right, so there, that's the receiving part. What part of a neuron is the sending part and why? The axon is the sending part because it has voltage-gated channels, like the sodium and potassium voltage-gated channels, to produce action potentials. Yeah, so that's pretty good information if you have that. Okay, so EPSPs and IPSPs summate. So here we have a cell body, and let's just say that these, I think these are red cells right here, come from two different cells, and let's just say that maybe this one right here is going to release a neurotransmitter that's going to cause depolarization or depolarizing graded potentials, but this one right here is going to produce a IPSP or a hyperpolarization. These electromagnetic waves flow over the cell body, but as they flow over, what happens to them? They start to die away, but here we see integration. Maybe more importantly, you should think that graded potentials can interact with each other. Right, so if you have an equal magnitude EPSP and an equal magnitude IPSP, they're going to exactly cancel each other out. So when they get to the axon hillock here, there won't be a change in membrane potential whatsoever. Right? And of course, if the membrane potential doesn't change whatsoever, it certainly doesn't meet threshold, and an action potential won't start down this axon. Okay. All right, let's take a look at the next slide right here. So this is just kind of a recapitulation of synaptic transmission. All right, for synaptic transmission, we need two cells, the presynaptic neuron and the postsynaptic neuron. And look at this arrow between the presynaptic neuron and the postsynaptic neuron. How many directions does it move? It only moves one way, kind of like the way an action potential moves down an axon. And you should probably be able to convince yourself that that is true and know why. That information does not go from the postsynaptic neuron back into the presynaptic neuron. It can only go from presynaptic to postsynaptic. So let's see if we can figure out why that is. Anybody see a good reason why that might be? I like that. Because one cell has a receptor. Which cell has the receptor? Only the postsynaptic cell. Right, so since the presynaptic cell has no receptor, it can't sense a chemical messenger, a chemical signaling molecule. All right, and another reason, which is kind of a corollary to that, is that only one of these cells can release a neurotransmitter. Can the postsynaptic cell release a neurotransmitter? No. And because it can't release a neurotransmitter, it cannot chemically stimulate another cell. So this signal can only go from presynaptic to postsynaptic cell. All right, so this slide here just says that action potentials conduct down an axon, right? You know, a couple different ways, continuous or saltatory conduction. But when it reaches the axon terminus right here, that action potential opens up voltage-gated channels for calcium, and that calcium is an important signaling molecule that binds to calmodulin and starts to regulate the biochemistry inside that terminal button, namely the fusion and docking and release of neurotransmitter by exocytosis into the synaptic cleft, right? And then how does neurotransmitter move across the synaptic cleft? Just by diffusion, right? Just a passive process. But all of these processes in here are active, but this is just diffusion. And in order to excite the cell or somehow control the postsynaptic cell, what does that neurotransmitter have to do when it bumps into the postsynaptic membrane right here? It's got to bind to a receptor that's going to change the state of a gate, either a sodium gate or a potassium gate. If it's a sodium gate, that's going to produce an EPSP. It's going to depolarize the cell. But if that neurotransmitter bumps into a ligand-gated potassium channel, then it's going to produce an IPSP or inhibit the cell. All depends on what kind of receptors are in that cell. And when, say, when the postsynaptic cell has an EPSP that sets up a graded potential, which moves very fast down to the axon hillock, and if the graded potential hasn't died away below threshold at the axon hillock, what happens there? Then you have an action potential starting because you have voltage-gated channels in that part of the cell, and then away goes another action potential down to the axon terminus of the postsynaptic cell right there. Okay, so let's look at some neurotransmitters. Don't forget a neurotransmitter, that's what I wanted to say. A neurotransmitter is a ligand, okay? And so it's going to bind to a ligand-gated channel someplace. It's the most widely used neurotransmitter in your body. It's used in the brain, autonomic nervous system, in the peripheral nervous system, and at all neuromuscular junctions. Oh, and I like reading that. Used at all neuromuscular junctions because there's a lot of information that I tell you in here which is true like 95% of the time, but you can always find a few obscure examples that don't behave to the rule. But here is a good rule that I don't think will ever be changed. Okay, acetylcholine is used at all neuromuscular junctions. And when you think neuromuscular junction, what should you be thinking about? What kind of system is that? It's motor, right? That's a motor system, but it is voluntary. Exactly, that's what I was thinking, right? So it's voluntary. As a matter of fact, neuromuscular junctions are really the only things that you have voluntary control of in your body, and that's due to the use of acetylcholine. All right, acetylcholine, sometimes we call these cholinergic neurons that release acetylcholine. There are a couple different receptor types. There are nicotinic-type receptors and muscarinic-type receptors. They both bind acetylcholine. And these different receptors can have different responses on the receiving cell or the postsynaptic cell. Sometimes it can be excitatory, and sometimes it can be inhibitory, depending on what kind of receptor it is. But we could probably tell you for sure, you could tell me, if it's excitatory, what kind of membrane channel is opening up? Sodium. And if it's inhibitory, it's going to be a potassium, okay? Because what's going to happen to potassium when a channel opens up? When you have a positive charge, namely potassium, leaves the cell, what happens to the electrical charge inside the cell? If a positive one leaves, it becomes more negative, right? And that's hyperpolarization, moves farther away from threshold. Okay, so if the inside of the cell becomes more negative, it is inhibited, but you know an ion that has a negative charge to it. It was, I think, on the last test, and you had to know where it was high concentration. There is one that's an anion, and it is chlorine. Okay, so chlorine is a negative ion, mostly outside the cell. Now, what happens if chlorine enters the cell? What happens to the membrane potential? It hyperpolarizes, and is that an excitatory or inhibitory event? It's inhibitory, right? It's not depolarization, it's hyperpolarization. So inhibition can be produced by the opening of either potassium channels or chloride channels, because then chloride will enter the cell and hyperpolarize it. So both of those will be inhibitory. Excitatory will be a sodium channel. Okay, ligand-gated channels, you've got to have a receptor site for the neurotransmitter. The neurotransmitter is a ligand. So here is a pretty nice example of a nicotinic-type acetylcholine channel. So we see a nice plasma membrane, phospholipid bilayer, but remember the fluid mosaic model. We add a lot of different proteins to membranes depending on how we want to regulate their function. This membrane channel spans, of course, across the membrane, and there are two receptor sites, right here and right here, and they have the complementary shape to acetylcholine. When there are two molecules of acetylcholine binding to this channel, it opens up. So here we see the channel is closed because it is not binding two molecules of acetylcholine. When the second one binds, it opens up, and predominantly sodium enters the cell. It's not completely specific for sodium. A little bit of potassium leaves, but because there's the biggest concentration for sodium entering the cell, it's mostly controlled by sodium entering the cell, which does what to the cell? It excites it because it produces depolarization and, right, a graded potential that we call an EPSP. So nicotinic type receptor channels are excitatory. They produce EPSPs. All right, and this is the kind of channel that we have in certain places in the autonomic nervous system and neuromuscular junctions. So every time these receptors bind acetylcholine in the neuromuscular junction, it always produces an excitatory event, which leads to what? Muscle contraction. Okay, so this is a typical nicotinic type receptor. All right, other kinds of acetylcholine receptors are G protein coupled channels. And you're tested on this one already. All right, in this particular case, the neurotransmitter receptor is not part of the ion channel. But remember, what happens with these G protein coupled receptors? There are subunits that can break away from the receptor molecule and do what? Float around on the surface, on the inside surface of the membrane, right? They can float around and maybe affect other kinds of proteins in remote locations on the cell membrane. All right, so one subunit is the membrane polypeptide, and when it becomes activated, it dissociates, floats around on the cell membrane, and when it bumps into an ion channel, that subunit can activate that ion channel. Maybe it can close it or it can open it. So here is a pretty good illustration of a muscarinic kind of acetylcholine channel. So it's not a direct ion channel. It requires some other activity right here. So here is the receptor molecule. Here is the receptor site. Here is the G protein. When the ligand binds to the receptor, it activates or causes dissociation of the G protein. Remember, the alpha unit dissociates from the beta and gamma unit. They can float around on and maybe even inside the cell membrane. So the beta and gamma unit bumps into this potassium channel and it opens it up, so potassium permeability increases. You have a lot of potassium leaving the cell, and what does that produce? That produces hyperpolarization, right? And an IPSP inhibiting the cell because the membrane potential has been driven farther away from threshold. All right, so this is just one example, but muscarinic channels can even bump into sodium channels, in which case it would cause depolarization or could be an excitatory event on the cell. All depends on these different channels right here that are in the cell membrane. But nonetheless, you should know that muscarinic channels are what class of membrane receptors? They are G protein coupled receptors, right? Not direct ion channels. Okay, well, when we stimulate a cell, right, when we stimulate this cell right here, we don't want it to be stimulated for the rest of your life, right? If you, so there might be channels like this that control your heart, but once acetylcholine binds to a receptor on your heart, we don't want then for your heart to be affected by that information for the rest of your life, right? So there should be a short duration so that communication can continue. So this acetylcholine molecule then is broken down. Let's look and see how acetylcholine is broken down so that the heart can be re-stimulated once again. Acetylcholinesterase, what can you tell me about this thing? There's an ASE on the end, which means what? It's an enzyme, and the substrate is acetylcholine. So here is an enzyme that can break acetylcholine down. So in these locations right here, acetylcholinesterase is a part of the postsynaptic membrane. Right, so when acetylcholine is released, it might spend part of the time in the receptor, right, and then in the synaptic cleft, and then it might be bound by the degrading enzyme acetylcholinesterase right here, which then breaks it down into acetate and choline. Right, you don't know what choline is, but you probably know what acetate is. What is acetate? If you're going to try to describe it to somebody, how many carbons does it have? It's just got two. And if you know that much, that's great, right? So the other thing is, since you're kind of familiar with it, you know that that's what? A Krebs cycle intermediate. So that will be taken up by the presynaptic cell again, and we can make some energy out of it, or maybe it can be recombined with choline to make more acetylcholine, right? And then sequestered in a vesicle, and it can be used as a neurotransmitter again. Okay, so acetylcholine terminates the action of acetylcholine when it's released, so that it then releases the communication across this synapse right here. There are many different kinds of neurotransmitters. Those that we've been talking about so far that use acetylcholine, we call those cholinergic neurons. So any neuron that releases acetylcholine is called cholinergic. And even motor neurons are cholinergic. They release a tremendous amount of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, and whenever an action potential reaches the end of a motor neuron, it always causes a sufficient EPSP, which we call an end plate potential in a skeletal muscle, to cause a threshold stimulus in that muscle, which then is going to cause that muscle to contract. All right, so anytime a muscle receives information from a motor neuron, it's always going to contract. And I think you would agree with that, right? You don't want to send a signal from your conscious brain down to a skeletal muscle and then have the skeletal muscle then make its own mind up whether it wants to contract or not, right? Every time you send an action potential down to a skeletal muscle, you just want it to contract to obey your voluntary commands. Okay, so that's... it always happens that way in skeletal muscle. And as a matter of fact, skeletal muscle is a little bit different than a neuron, because even under that neuromuscular junction, there are voltage-gated channels, so an action potential starts immediately right on that part of the skeletal muscle, and that action potential is transmitted over the whole cell membrane of a muscle cell when that happens, and that causes muscle contraction. There's a chemical that can block the binding of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction. That's called curare. That's an alkaloid from plants. And when insects eat that plant, then they accumulate curare. And then when other animals eat those insects, then those animals can accumulate curare. And there's one kind of animal that has learned how to take that curare that it's received from insects and secrete it onto their skin, so it doesn't block their neuromuscular junctions. But then that also acts as, what, a nice chemical weapon, right, so that other animals know not to eat them, to leave them alone, like very pretty colored frogs in South America. And then people learn to take that slime from frogs, which contains, what, curare, and coat that on little arrows, actually little darts that they shoot with a bow. And because of that chemical signal right here that blocks neuromuscular junctions, they can hunt very big game as a result of that, right? And that just poisons then the neuromuscular junction and skeletal muscles in those animals that they are hunting. But as you can imagine, you'd have to be careful with that stuff. Another kind of neurotransmitter, monoamine neurotransmitters. Here's a number of them: serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. All right. Serotonin is derived from amino acid tryptophan. Norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from tyrosine. Both tryptophan and tyrosine are what we call essential amino acids. So what is an essential nutrient to you? What does that mean? That means you have to have it in your diet. An essential nutrient is a nutrient that you need in order to maintain homeostasis, but your body cannot produce it itself, or cannot produce it in sufficient quantity to maintain homeostasis. All right, so that's both tryptophan and tyrosine. So what kind of foodstuffs have tryptophan and tyrosine in it? enough to keep you healthy. It is a meat protein. It's not vegetable protein, right? So here is something pretty interesting, right? Your diet can affect the proper levels of neurotransmitters that you have in your nervous system, right? And I think we're going to talk about it. These can also affect or have an influence on, you know, how you're feeling, how you're behaving, right? How you're learning information, right? So I think that's fascinating, right? That somebody might actually be affected by schizophrenia or depression based on their diet, just solely on their diet. Okay, so these pathways that, or these chemicals right here, norepinephrine and dopamine, are what we call catecholamines. They're just a class of monoamines. All right, so here is a synapse. Now, what kind of synapse is this right here? Is this an electrical synapse or a chemical synapse? It's chemical because it's using a neurotransmitter. Remember, that's just a ligand. So again, when there is an action potential that comes down to the axon terminus, it's going to change the state of what kind of protein in the presynaptic membrane right here? Yeah, it's going to depolarize, right? So there's going to be a change in membrane potential, but in this terminal button, there's another kind of voltage-gated channel, and it is calcium. Yeah, so if calcium voltage-gated channel opens up, calcium enters the cell, that changes metabolism and physiology inside this terminal button. It causes fusing and docking of these vesicles that contain neurotransmitter, that exocytosis neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft, and it diffuses over to the postsynaptic cell. And what do we see right here? What does that kind of look like to you? Does this look like an ion channel or a G protein coupled receptor? Yeah, it's a G protein coupled receptor. So epinephrine work through G protein coupled receptors. All right, but we want to terminate the signal, this norepinephrine signal, right, so that this synapse can then continue to send information to the postsynaptic cell. Inactivation is not accomplished by enzymes on the postsynaptic cell. Termination of the signal is due to reuptake of the neurotransmitter into the presynaptic cell. All right, so it can take neurotransmitter back up, and that neurotransmitter can be reincorporated into vesicles, or it can be broken down in the presynaptic cell. There is an enzyme that does that. It's called monoamine oxidase. Will break norepinephrine down. And then these building blocks can be used for various purposes by the cell, maybe resynthesizing neurotransmitter, or can be used for other purposes. So what terminates the action of norepinephrine in this kind of synapse is not degradation, okay, but what we call reuptake. So if we want to enhance the transmission, synaptic transmission in this kind of synapse, okay, then what could we do to enhance the excitatory events on this postsynaptic cell right here? If we want to increase the amount of norepinephrine in the synaptic cleft, what would we want to do? Decrease or block the uptake of it, right? The reuptake. And that's typically one way that's done with reuptake inhibitors, right, to enhance or potentiate the effects of norepinephrine at various synapses in the body. All right, so let's look in a little bit more detail at the G protein coupled receptor. So here we have the signaling molecule on the outside of the cell. Why do you think it's outside the cell? Because norepinephrine is a polar compound. It can't get through the cell membrane, right? So it's a polar compound. Polar compounds have receptors that are extracellular or on the cell membrane. If it was a nonpolar compound, then the receptor would be inside the cell. So this is a signal transduction pathway that takes a signal from outside the cell, and we figure out a way, how does it get inside the cell? So let's look and see how that signal gets inside the cell. This polar signaling molecule binds to a receptor. So here's the receptor, and it's coupled to a G protein. The G protein becomes activated when the ligand binds to the receptor. It dissociates. The alpha unit can float around in the membrane someplace, as well as the beta and gamma subunit. The alpha subunit bumps into an enzyme, which is an integral part of the cell membrane, and it is called adenylate cyclase. All right, cyclase is ASE, you know that's an enzyme. And cyclase is kind of an interesting enzyme because it can take a molecule that's sort of linear, like ATP, and can hydrolyze it and form a ring structure. And we call that cyclic AMP. So it looks like a ring, but it's just AMP. So two phosphates come off of ATP and forms a ring structure right here called cyclic AMP. So here's a pretty good question maybe for the test. What kind of enzyme produces cyclic AMP? Or what's the name of one? It is adenylate cyclase. I would guess this is an exam figure, would be my guess. Okay, so that would be a good way to answer that question. Adenylate cyclase takes ATP and makes cyclic AMP out of it. Okay. Now, where do we have cyclic AMP? Is it inside the cell or outside the cell? It's inside the cell. So, what do we have outside the cell? The first messenger. What do we have inside the cell? Second messenger. Maybe you have a table someplace in your notes that says that cyclic AMP is a good example of a second messenger someplace. All right, so how is cyclic AMP as a second messenger produced? It's produced by activation of a G protein coupled receptor, which then activates a membrane enzyme, which converts ATP into cyclic AMP. So now we have this signal inside the cell, the cyclic AMP signal. But before we go to the next step, what can you tell me about adenylate cyclase because it's an enzyme? Does it become inactivated when it converts one ATP into a cyclic AMP? No, what happens to this enzyme right here? Well, it's happy to catalyze the reaction over again. And what? Over again. And over again and over again and over again until this alpha subunit dissociates from it. All right, so adenylate cyclase can produce thousands of cyclic AMPs. All right, but this all started due to the binding of how many norepinephrines outside the cell? Just one. So one molecule produces thousands of second messenger molecules inside the cell. Okay? That's interesting. So what do we call that when you go from a little signal to a big signal? What do we call it when we go from a little signal to a bigger signal? What do we call that? What do we call that? That is annoying. But what is that? That is amplification. Okay? So these G protein coupled systems can amplify these signals right here. All right, so now we have a lot of cyclic AMP running around inside the cell, and it's going to run into a protein kinase that is inactive, and when it binds to it, it then changes the conformation of that protein, causes it to go into an active form. And what is a kinase? It's an enzyme, right, that phosphorylates, and when it phosphorylates something, does it become inactivated? Does the enzyme get used up in the reaction? No. So here we have an enzyme that can phosphorylate many things. So here's another level of amplification, right? Because that enzyme is not degraded when it undergoes the reaction. All right, so here is another level of amplification. So we call this a cascade mechanism. All right, so here is the first step of amplification. Here's the second step of amplification. So one tiny signal can cause what? Massive changes in a hurry inside the cell because of a cascade mechanism with these different levels of amplification in it. So that's really one of the more important things that you should realize in this cell, in this slide right here. Okay, serotonin is involved with regulation of mood, behavior, appetite, and even circulation inside the brain. LSD is structurally similar, so people would use this as a recreational drug to alter what? Their mood and behavior, and in even higher doses, their perception of reality. And this system right here can be used to treat depression. There are serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors, which will potentiate the effect of serotonin, right, and can be used as antidepressants. Some examples of these are Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, Luvox. Right? They block reuptake of serotonin, doing what? That then prolongs the action of serotonin that is released in certain synapses in people that are, okay, victims of that particular affective disorder. So this is a really nice example of the biology involved with and understanding and treating affective disorders. Right? So affective disorders are just like any other kind of medical condition that we have. Unfortunately, there probably is still a huge stigma associated with schizophrenia and depression. And, you know, it's basically just like having a cold, but the manifestations are a little bit different, right? Can usually be treated pretty effectively. Another kind of neurotransmitter is dopamine, dopamine. We have two major pathways in the body, this nigrostriatal dopamine system, and it's involved with control of skeletal muscles in the sense that it inhibits skeletal muscles, and that's important to have very fluid motion, right? In order for you to move, remember, muscles work by antagonism. In order for one muscle to contract like your biceps and have your arm move in a nice fluid motion, what has to happen to the triceps? It has to be inhibited. It has to relax, right? So if the triceps can't relax, then you can't move your arm. So people with Parkinson's disease have trouble with that because they can't have antagonistic muscles relax in the proper magnitude and in the proper time. Okay, so that's due to this system right here, which is part of the basal nuclei. So a partial treatment we're thinking for Parkinson's disease is drugs that potentiate the effect of dopamine in this particular system right here, or transplant of neuronal cells that are still healthy that can synthesize dopamine for those neurons. All right, so it's involved with the motor system, but there's another system called the mesolimbic dopamine system involved with behavior and emotional reward. And this is the one system that most addicts activate by taking other kinds of drugs, okay, and like heroin, amphetamines, and things of that nature. Overactivity in this system right here doesn't have motor effects, right, but it affects consciousness. Overactivity contributes to schizophrenia. And so schizophrenia can be treated usually pretty well with anti-dopaminergic drugs, like clonazine would be one. All right, so I think this kind of just underscores how important understanding different synapses work by different kinds of neurotransmitters. All right, we talked about norepinephrine. It's used both in the peripheral nervous system and central nervous system. In the peripheral nervous system, it's a sympathetic neurotransmitter, especially in the postganglionic cell. So sympathetic, what's the opposite? This is part of the autonomic nervous system. What's the other part of the autonomic nervous system? The parasympathetic. And if you're going to think of those two nervous systems, then that might be the next chapter where we really discuss it. Is there a nice simple way that we can think about how one works in your body compared to another one? Have you heard that the sympathetic is the fight and flight nervous system and the parasympathetic is the rest and digest or rest and repose? So the parasympathetic stimulates digestion, okay? The sympathetic does not stimulate, it inhibits digestion, but it stimulates heart rate, right? It dilates your eyes so that you can see, it increases respiration so that you can physically interact more forcefully with your environment. Okay, in the central nervous system, it affects general level of arousal, that's a consciousness state, right? And so amphetamines stimulate these norepinephrine pathways in the brain. All right, so here's a pretty important slide. Some amino acids are neurotransmitters. And I didn't have you memorize a whole bunch of amino acids, but glutamic acid is one of them. Aspartic acid is one. Glycine is very important, right? And gamma-aminobutyric acid is just a modified amino acid. And what else can you do with these amino acids? Or what else does your body do with these amino acids? It makes proteins out of them. Right, so these are just some of the basic building blocks of proteins. Glutamic acid and aspartic acid are major central nervous system excitatory neurotransmitters. All right, so how would you guess they work? They bind to a receptor that does what? That opens up a sodium channel, causes depolarization. Right? Glycine, on the other hand, is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. How would you want to how can you inhibit a cell? Opening up a potassium channel or a chloride channel right here. All right, so glycine binds to a chloride channel. and it hyperpolarizes cells that causes inhibition. Here is a compound that can bind to that receptor, and it blocks the binding of glycine to the receptor, so it poisons that receptor. All right, so if you poison a inhibitory kind of receptor, guess what happens to your body? It becomes overexcited, right? So strychnine poisoning is characterized by muscle spasms and paralysis all over your body. And mostly the muscles that are strongest in your body are flexors and back muscles. So when people have strychnine poisoning, they're just in these weird, awful, contorted positions when we find them, because the motor neurons from the spinal cord just cause all those skeletal muscles to contract. And if you can't relax the skeletal muscle, then you can't breathe, and unfortunately you die of just asphyxia. Okay, gamma-aminobutyric acid, that's the most common neurotransmitter in the brain, and it is inhibitory as well. Okay, and again, it works through chloride channels. So I suppose you might be a little surprised to find out that there are many inhibitory pathways in your body as well as excitatory. But why should that not be very startling to you? Because how do you have precise control and balance over various things in your body? It is through through antagonistic systems, right? So here we have antagonistic neurotransmitters that maintain precise control and balance in your body. All right, so along those lines, let's look at some EPSPs and IPSPs. So remember, graded potentials are, well, they're variable in amplitude, and an EPSP or an IPSP is graded in nature. They have no threshold. Right, EPSPs cause depolarization. IPSPs cause hyperpolarization, right, the opposite. EPSPs can summate, and they have no refractory period, but they do travel real fast, that's for sure. All right, so an example we have right here is a postsynaptic neuron, and we have dendrites in the cell body right here. We have two neurons synapsing on it. It's going to release a neurotransmitter that's going to open up sodium channels that produce EPSPs, which then flow over the cell body. Okay, and when they converge into this area right here, we call the axon hillock, notice that they can actually summate with each other, right? Because this thing right here kind of looks like a funnel. Think of it as a funnel just funneling electrical signals down into this region right here. Now, what changes in the membrane right at this location? Instead of having ligand-gated channels, now you have voltage-gated channels, and if these graded potentials are at threshold, then that will start an action potential, and it can then move down the axon right here. All right, so there is something we call spatial summation. It takes place when ESPAs from different synapses, okay, occur on the postsynaptic cell at the same time. So here we have two neurons, and they release neurotransmitter at the same time, but at what? Two different locations on the postsynaptic cell. These two EPSPs, maybe singularly or alone, when it reaches the axon hillock, can't reach threshold. But because graded potentials can summate, right? And it summates right here in this funnel region, which is the axon hillock, it reaches threshold, and so now this cell has made a decision based on these voltage-gated channels right here to pass that information on down the axon to other cells. So it's sharing information. So spatial summation occurs when a postsynaptic cell receives information from more than one cell at the same time. Okay, temporal summation kind of is similar, right? And it can be due to ESPs, EPSPs, or combinations of EPSPs and IPSPs that occur closely in time, and they can summate before they fade, because EPSPs and IPSPs sometimes are long in duration, right, depending on how much neurotransmitter is released across the synapse. So GABA and glycine produce IPSPs, right, and IPSPs can counteract or dampen EPSPs, and it makes the postsynaptic cell harder to reach threshold. So this is what we're going to call presynaptic inhibition. It occurs when one neuron synapses onto an axon or a bouton of another Oh, that's not on this slide. That's on this one right here. Presynaptic inhibition. So here we see three axons synapsing on the cell. And maybe in anatomy you can remember what some of these synapses are called. Here is a axodendritic synapse, because it synapses on a dendrite. Here is an axonic synapse. No, axosomatic synapse, because it synapses on the soma or the cell body. But now here is one that we're just becoming familiar with. What is this right here of the presynaptic neuron? That is an axon. So this is what? An axoaxonic synapse. So this synapse right here can actually modulate the activity of action potentials reaching the terminus of the presynaptic neuron, right? If it's producing hyperpolarization, it could actually block out an action potential that is flowing down this cell right here. Okay, so this is what we call presynaptic inhibition. If, for instance, neurotransmitter causes hyperpolarization, maybe due to chloride channels or opening of potassium channels, it can block an action potential reaching this axon terminus. And if an action potential is blocked from this axon terminus, what happens to release of neurotransmitter right here? It is blocked as well. So then the synapse is blocked. So you got these three different kinds of synapses. And remember, they can produce EPSPs or IPSPs depending on what kind of receptors and ion channels they have associated with them. All right, so I've kind of covered everything that could be on the test for Tuesday. Don't forget, IPSPs and EPSPs, they can cancel each other out because they can summate. So the handiest figures that I think about for this test, I don't know if they're on the exam or not. Okay, this one right here, this is a good picture you should have in your mind for integrating metabolism. And then the hand-drawn neuron that a previous student drew out, right, and just labeled different kinds of gated channels, what part of the neuron is the sending part, which is the receiving part. So you should know those different proteins in the cell membrane that give different function to different parts of the neuron. That's a pretty good one. Okay, some questions in online, depending on what version you look at, I don't have a good example, we're kind of running out of time right here, have different answers, right? And so I get some emails sometimes saying, well, which one is the correct one? Well, if you send me an email, I want to get your impression. Because sometimes I give you a question that has two different answers depending on the version, because then you just can't memorize the answer. You really have to understand something about that particular question. So it's a really good learning tool. So if you send me a question, tell me what is your impression and why you're thinking a certain way. So it's more important to develop a thinking process than just a memorizing process. Okay? And I can't remember a good question that goes over that one. Okay, I could find it if you want to wait around. Okay, so that's it for today. Oh, did I pass the sign-in? I didn't pass the sign-in sheet around. Oh, well, it's too late. Okay, remind me next time.